Hi, I'm Neil Jackson, and you're listening to Stargirl After Show.
This is the Stargirl After Show with Sarah and Sean. Your post-show breakdown of DC Stargirl with Easter eggs, exclusive behind-the-scenes info, and cast and crew interviews.
This is our destiny.
I finally know who I really am.
I'm Stargirl.
This is the Stargirl After Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to Stargirl After Show, as always sponsored by Stargirl.tv and DCTV.news, your best resources for news, media, and spoilers about Stargirl and other DC Comics properties. I'm Sean.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week we're talking to you about Episode 3, Icicle.
Yeah, this one really changed the show for me, my view of it. We'll do a quick summary here. Now that Courtney has, you know, quote unquote, stopped Brainwave, she now sets her sights on the recently returned Icicle, who is the leader of the Injustice Society and who she believes killed her father. But he is proving to be a more difficult challenge than Brainwave was, both in costume and out.
So it really was a great episode. And it should be noted the first that is not different on the DC Universe app from the CW. So if you're listening to this, you're not going to hear anything that confuses you if you listen on the CW.
Yeah, that's good. Is there like maybe like a minute or two difference, or is it completely the same?
It's possible that there's like 45 seconds to a minute difference, but I don't think that would be anything enough to confuse people. Mm-hmm. Real quick, let's go over what was different in episode 2, because we record these before the CW drops, so we don't know for episode 2 what changed. So I did head over to some articles online that went through it, and what we're missing over there were, strangely, the scene where Brainwave turns up in William Zarek's house. That entire scene cut.
Wow.
Also the scene where Barbara was pitching to CFO Sharp, and he was shooting down all her ideas. That also completely cut.
Wow. Okay.
And then some other things, little things here and there, but those are the two like big scenes that were cut that I'm very surprised by.
Yeah, because they kind of set up a lot.
Yeah, but that's the point, is they were there to set up things that happen in this episode.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you can still follow along by right. Watching this one. Yep.
So we get reference to the phone call. To the conversation that Brainwave and the Wizard had mm-hmm. in episode 2. So, you know, if you watched on the CW, you didn't see that conversation. But if you watched on the DC Universe app, you did see that conversation. And then for the American Dream thing with Barbara, that just showed why she was so hesitant to speak up in this meeting. Mm-hmm. Because she'd been so thoroughly shot down in the previous, but it still plays just fine if you didn't have that scene, I think.
All right, so I kind of saw an overarching theme to this episode, and that was about family. Specifically, families not doing too well, I guess.
But really, we open 8 years ago with a scene that sets up all of Icicle's motivations.
Yeah, so 8 years ago in Blue Valley already, Jordan's wife is dying of cancer. We don't know any details about it. He kind of talks about it later on. And she sees her son, and he draws her a picture of a flower from her garden. She tells him to always keep drawing. And then she makes Jordan promise to continue his mission and make the world safe for their son. And to do that at any expense.
If anyone gets in your way, destroy them. Are her dying words.
Yeah.
Those are some strong dying words.
Yes. And I would be very good motivation for him to continue that mission.
Yeah. And it's really unexpected. You know, you think that because he immediately goes to like revenge mode. He's like, I'll kill everyone that did this to you. And she's like, continue your mission, but yo, destroy some people if you need to.
Yeah. And so,
and I didn't see that one coming.
No. I'm very curious about her backstory now, to see what would, you know, I know when people are sick at the end of their life, you know, sometimes they kind of lose their mind. Was it something like that? Or was she always kind of a little bit evil in telling him to do stuff like that? Was she his partner? Because this was 8 years ago, 10 years ago was the big battle that killed the JSA. So we already know that Icicle was a villain at that point. And so,
well, but is it evil though? Because she's telling him, go ahead and make the world a better place. Just don't let people get in your way. Like, if you have to destroy people to make the world a better place, then do that. And I think that's the, I don't think what she's saying is evil. I think it's just, you know, for the greater good kind of thing.
Yeah. I think destroying people is kind of evil. So that's, I guess that's how I'm defining it.
Right. Understood. But later on, when we hear from Neil Jackson, we'll get more into that whole good versus evil and motivation thing. So then when we get into the modern day and we check in on our first family, basically right out of the gate, Courtney is like, yo, we need to hunt down some Injustice Society people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Pat's like, no, we need to come up with a plan. And that's where Courtney has her 3-point plan.
Right.
And he, you know, I think he finally kind of convinces her to go to school, but she's still barking orders at him and saying, you know, what they're going to do.
And then, of course, we check in with Brainwave. And there's a couple interesting things going on here. First, we've got a coffee cup moving itself.
Yeah, and his son seemed very surprised by it.
Yeah, I mean, he was asleep. It woke him up. And it's weird that the camera was looking at him when it happened. So is Brainwave waking up? Is Henry displaying some powers? Who can say?
Yeah.
It's very vague at this point.
Yeah. And then we have Jordan shows up outside the window.
But before that, actually before the coffee cup moves even, I have our first Easter egg. And unfortunately, you barely see it, but I will post it to our socials and our website so everyone can see. At 6:31, there's a candy wrapper there. And the candy wrapper, I went through great lengths to make. I had to make up a name. I had to get it cleared through our legal company. And I made up a logo. What I made up is Nodello. I think that sounds like a candy bar name, right?
Mm-hmm, I think so.
But it's named for Martin Nodell, the guy who created the Golden Age Green Lantern.
Oh.
And I made the wrapper in Green Lantern's colors. It's purple and yellow and green, like that Green Lantern's outfit.
Oh, that's awesome.
I really wanted to get a Martin Nodell reference in there because I met him a couple of times in my youth at conventions. I had some Alan Scott drawings by him that sadly no longer exist. Really wanted to get that in there. And all you see is sort of the back of the wrapper, but you can see that it says Nodello if you look closely. Again, check our socials. I'll have that for you. 6:31 if you want to freeze frame it for whatever.
Oh, very cool. But yeah, because you grew up reading Green Lantern, right? Wasn't he your superhero?
Him and Batman. They're my first two.
Very nice. So later at the hospital, Pat does a little bit investigating too. And him going there, he's kind of not very smoothly asking around. And he finds out that Brainwave isn't alone because someone changed him into his lab coat. And we later find out that was Zarek, but...
I like that he is not being very smooth.
Nope.
But he did do good detective work. He found out he was found outside and he was not wearing his green supersuit. So he deducts, he's not alone. Someone covered this up.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to Courtney arriving at school because there are a couple things going on here. I loved everyone freaking out at the melted sign from her battle with Brainwave in episode 2.
Yeah, and I love how embarrassed she seemed about it. And we had the janitor there again looking at Courtney like he suspects something.
Right, and this whole, I didn't even notice the whole, everyone freaking out about the sign scene the first time I watched it through. And I don't recall that being called out in the script. So I think director Michael Nankin may have, just thrown that in. We need to, acknowledge this sign and people reacting to it. Though, apologies to writer Colleen McGinnis if it is in the script and I just don't remember it. But so you've got that, and then you have Courtney meeting Joey Zarek at her locker. And I thought this was a really great scene because he's he messes up the trick, first of all.
Yeah. And she is wonderful because she's the only one who saw it, or she thinks. And so she makes him think that he did it correctly. It makes him look like a magician to everyone around. And I think that was the sweetest thing.
I mean, a nicer thing to do would have been to do that, but then to catch up to him and go, look, I didn't want you to be embarrassed in front of everybody, but you did something wrong. You should work on that trick before tonight's performance, maybe.
That, yeah.
That's just me. And I want to point out something about the card that was presented to her, not the one she actually picked, was the Three of Clubs, which... If you're a Magic fan, you'll know that this is the Penn and Teller preferred card. In their Magic books, when they're teaching you Magic tricks, it's always, always the Three of Clubs.
Interesting.
So I imagine that when this was written in, it was as a nod to Penn and Teller.
I like that.
It's just the famous card they always use.
Yeah, last episode, Joey was wearing the Houdini shirt, and now this one, the Penn and Teller card. Yeah, I think that makes sense that they're paying homage to them.
Yeah, either it's an homage, or they thought, okay, Joey's going to read anybody's magic book voraciously. Mm-hmm. So he's probably read Penn and Teller's books, so he'll use the Three of Clubs.
Mm-hmm.
I love that Cameron clocks that it was not the right card.
Yes.
And he sort of has that moment with her where he's gauging her and he's okay, I can respect you being nice to the nerdy magic kid.
Yeah. Yeah. That was very important that he saw that. And then also in the same entrance in school, we see that Yolanda has slut written on her locker. And when Courtney tries to go up to help her, Yolanda is not having it.
She turns around and storms off, and I didn't notice this until watching this right before we recorded this episode, but she actually does look very upset. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, she's just sort of resigned to what's going on and just sort of shut down. Mm-hmm. But as she turns away from her locker and storms off, she looks like she's about to cry.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a little bit of a gut punch if you notice it. She's moving real fast, so it's a little hard to notice. But I did clock that this fourth watch through.
Yeah. Then we do a cut over to the Zarek's house, where we have the reference to the conversation that we mentioned that wasn't in the CW episode. In episode 2, where Jordan is kind of laying in the wizard for not being in charge like he wanted him to.
Here's what really stands out to me is, and I talk about this with Neil Jackson in the interview later, so you're just going to have to deal with me repeating myself. But, comic books are full of these bad guy team names, like the Injustice Society or the Crime Syndicate or the Legion of Doom. They're all very evil sounding.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Brotherhood of Evil, for example. And, modern bad guys never think of themselves as being bad guys. So it's really hard to justify calling yourselves the Injustice Society if you're on the side of good or mm-hmm. believe you yourselves to be.
Yeah.
But what Jeff does in this dialogue here, or Colleen McGinnis, I should say, is Icicle says, I'm combating injustice.
Mm-hmm.
They're called the Injustice Society because it's named for what they are opposed to.
Yes.
And I love that.
Yeah, they handle that really well in here. Because, yeah, I think he thinks he's doing the right thing. I'm not sure the Brainwave kind of thought the same thing, but I guess there's degrees to everyone. And in this conversation is when Jordan says that he hunted down everyone who exposed his wife to a toxin that made her sick. And that he did it for his son.
Yeah, so basically it's like some company, I guess.
I was kind of thinking, yeah, there was a company, and so everyone that worked for it, he kind of went for. Yeah, I don't know. He kind of leaves it open. Who knows how many people he took out.
Maybe she worked for a company in a field where she wasn't given proper protective equipment mm-hmm. and was exposed to something.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we're talking classic superhero superpowers origin story right there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a possibility.
Yeah.
Except instead of superpowers, she got, you know, cancer.
Yeah, it's the other way it could go. Because we don't know how Icicle got his powers, correct? They haven't said anything about that in the show so far?
They have not.
Yeah. So who knows if he was some kind of experiment that went wrong or what happened there. And then the other really big thing is William Zarek says that there is nothing that matters more to him than his son.
Than his family, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Icicle just kind of makes a note of that. Or Jordan. I'm sorry, he was Jordan at that part.
I think it's interchangeable. I think Jordan and Icicle aren't exactly the same person, but I don't think he has to be iced up to be Icicle. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which actually leads me to my next point pretty well, is that I love that he's being played so differently than Brainwave.
Mm-hmm.
Because Brainwave is basically creepy all the time. Henry King isn't actually less creepy than Brainwave. He just wears glasses.
Exactly.
That's just who that guy is. But as we see at the American Dream, Jordan isn't always menacing like Icicle. He's like a friendly guy. He's very open and charming. Like, I would be friends with that guy for sure.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so I can see how he's been so successful. As a leader of the American Dream.
Yeah, he's open and receptive to ideas
mm-hmm.
to the point where he just shoots down an entire plan, just shuts it completely down to pursue an idea that was presented to him 15 seconds prior.
Mm-hmm.
And within the day, he started a whole task force to oversee that task because it's right for the community. Even if it loses money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you really get the sense that he is all about family and community and building that up. Even though his methods may speak differently, I think that is truly his intention. He reminds me a lot of Killmonger in Black Panther, who he had. His end game was what he wanted, but the way about it was not the right way to go.
Yeah, and I think that's a defining characteristic of a lot of the most compelling bad guys in fiction. You know, even the devil isn't a purely evil figure. He started as an angel who felt like he was being treated unjustly
mm-hmm.
and passed over for humans. You know, it's that deeper thing. Like in the 40s, bad guys could pop around and go, I'm here to do evil, ha ha ha. And it was just for little kids and they ate it up. That doesn't mm-hmm. fly anymore.
No. I think Icicle was built up really well in this.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And Neil Jackson, my God, the man's doing such a good job.
Yeah, he is. He's believable as both parts of it.
And can I say, I have sort of an ear for fake American accents. And I can't hear it. This man is British, but he just sounds American.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, he nails it.
Back at the school, we see that someone has painted a flower over the word slut on Yolanda's locker.
And Cindy is there harassing Yolanda. We find out it's because Yolanda dated Henry when Cindy liked him.
And that jumped out at me because Yolanda sits at the loser table.
Mm-hmm.
When we first meet Henry, he's coming over and calling her a slut. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like a bad breakup.
Yeah. Oh, in that same scene, Cindy was saying that that's her boyfriend. So she obviously right. got her way.
So they're really building over, I think, all three episodes at this point, some sort of history there mm-hmm. between these two. And I'm loving it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then later in math class, Courtney sees Cameron is doodling in his book. And she sees that he's drawing the same flowers that were drawn over on Yolanda's locker. And so she calls him out for doing something good. And they kind of have a little bit of a moment there.
Yeah, I like the little flirtation between them
mm-hmm.
and her nervousness
mm-hmm.
at like explaining how she knows his name.
Yeah, yeah, that was cute. But her day quickly turns south when she's walking home and finds a frozen star right in the middle of Blue Valley Park.
But before we get there, I wanted to touch on a quick thing. I know we already talked about Jordan making his task force for the community theater,
mm-hmm.
but there's some really great stuff going on with Barbara in that scene before he comes in.
Mm-hmm.
First, I want to point out at 2240, her world's greatest mom mug. I just want you to notice that. Because it's got like a little kid's drawn like woman face on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I drew that.
Very nice.
I used my left hand. I'm right-handed. So that it would look all childish. Nice. And I was just real happy about that. So I just wanted to point that out. But what's really great that's going on here is she's got Mike and Pat in one frame and her and Courtney in another.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like separated by like a foot of space. She's mm-hmm. sort of moving them together. And you'll notice the frames don't match.
Yeah.
So it's like she's trying to force this family together. And it's a fantastic metaphor for what's going on overall in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good catch.
But you were talking about Courtney going to the park. And I do want to point out, on her way to the park, she sees Rick leaning against the wall where the mural is, just mm-hmm. apparently day drinking.
Yeah.
And that's all we see of Rick. He yep. sort of glares at her and storms off, and she continues on to Blue Valley Park.
Yeah, I'm really excited to learn more about him. I feel like he's going to be quite the complicated character. So Courtney finds the frozen star and immediately goes to talk to Pat, and she's like, "We need to go. Icicle's here." And he's like, "It's a trap." And she says, "We still need to go."
It's the most obvious trap I've ever seen.
Yep. Yep. They get there and it was obviously a trap. And Stripe immediately gets iced, can't move. And Courtney just takes off.
I want to talk about Courtney convincing Pat. Because he's not going to do it. And then the staff's like, "Hey, man, you're outvoted." And suddenly they're just like flying through the air on their way to the park. I just really loved that.
Yeah, I love how much of a character the staff is, because it really is. It has its own personality and opinions and everything.
But what this also means is that they're skipping out on the family dinner that Barbara passed up the meeting for
mm-hmm.
in order to attend.
Yeah.
But as you said, Stripe gets iced up straight away and... When this happened, I checked the time indicator on my player, and it was like another 15 or 20 minutes left in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, they're not going to have a 20-minute fight. They're having a weird in-the-middle-of-the-episode fight.
I actually had the same thought as I was watching it. I was like, whoa, it is... that's definitely more of a last 5 minutes kind of thing.
Yeah, typically. And I thought it was bold and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Courtney takes off after Icicle kind of on her own, and he is about to, you know, attack her. And Stripe comes to the rescue with his fist flying through the air and taking Icicle all the way across the river down towards a bridge over there.
River, lake, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Difficult to say.
Yeah. Which, unfortunately, that is where the bus full of the students who were at the talent show are coming, and Icicle ices over the bridge, and the bus is falling off.
So, yeah, Stripe has to rescue it, and there's, like, this whole, hey, this one kid's staring right at me, and Courtney blinds him with the staff.
Yeah, that was a new power that I didn't know she knew how to do that.
But I think that's what's great about it, right? Is mm-hmm. she intuited that yes. she could do that.
Yes, exactly.
Because, again, her and the staff have some sort of connection. Mm-hmm. I don't think she can hear its thoughts in her head, but I think, as I said, there's some sort of intuition that goes with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And we buy it, you know? We don't really question, like, oh, how does she know how to do that?
Yeah, it definitely was just like, boom, I know this.
Because the staff has so much character, like, we just automatically accept it. I never gave it a second thought, did you?
No, I didn't. I was just excited to see a new power it had.
So they save them, and then, you know, we know what happens. Icicle blows the card out of Joey's hand, ices up the tires on the truck, and Joey's dead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand really what happened to Icicle. I think he probably iced the bridge to buy himself a distraction so he could run off, because he was not prepared to fight a giant robot. Mm-hmm. Nobody mentioned a giant robot before.
Nope. Just said
the only person that had seen one was in a coma.
Exactly. I really love that Courtney doesn't blame herself, because too often in shows and movies, the hero is like, well, had I not gone there, then Icicle wouldn't have been there. He wouldn't have attacked the bus and Joey wouldn't be dead. When really the blame is on Icicle. He's the one that did it. And I think I am really happy that it's not showing her in that spiral. It is, no, he is evil. He is who needs to be defeated.
There is still time for her to have that spiral, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it does look at this point like she's not going down that road.
Yeah.
Because she's pretty dedicated to, like, yeah, we need to stop these guys. But
yes.
We will get there. First, I want to talk about parental grief. The way Denise and William Zarek, like, she was watching the news. She knew a kid on her son's bus died. And she's mm-hmm. worried and she's kind of freaking out. She doesn't know if it's her son. And then William getting the news and wordlessly telling her, and then, like, their face, like, God, they sold it. They're just such good yep. actors, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, they nailed it. That was heartbreaking.
I was a wreck watching it. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I teared up a little bit during this episode. Joey was such a sweet kid. I feel so bad for his mom.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, the actor who plays William Zarek, and Joe, I know you're probably listening, and I'm really sorry. I have no clue how to pronounce your last name. We'll talk soon, and you can let me know. But I don't have the first clue how to pronounce his name. We'll just call him Joe K. So we actually checked in with Joe and found that his name is pronounced
Knezovich.
That's Joe
Knezovich.
They both just killed it mm-hmm. in this episode.
They did.
So here's a big scene. You know, Courtney is crushed. Mm-hmm. She's very upset. I'm gonna say this is the first time she's ever watched anyone die.
I think so.
And it was a classmate of hers, a sweet boy she met just that very day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hit her pretty hard, but she wants to stop Icicle. So Pat takes her to the JSA headquarters.
And this is just another example of where he is trying to steer her away from this life. And all he does is motivate her even further to do it.
She has a one-track mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really needs to start learning to think in a new way if he wants to convince her of anything ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because every single thing that he said, she went, yeah, but no.
Mm-hmm.
And then her counterpoint made a certain kind of sense, and enough sense that you're like, yeah, she walked into that one.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's so frustrating as a parent when the kids start making sense.
Yeah, it's no one can take their place. That said about Starman, and the staff chose me.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's a kid died. So we have to stop this. A kid died, and that's why we have to keep going.
Yeah.
Difficult to argue with that.
Yeah. Oh, I love her spirit. Also in the JSA headquarters, this is the second time I teared up during this episode, because I think it is so sad that Dr. Midnight's owl doesn't know that he's dead and is just sitting there waiting.
Okay. So I've got some behind the scenes stuff for this scene.
Okay.
The table is 10 feet in diameter.
That's big.
I designed it, which is to say that I picked a font, basically. And we worked out how deep to engrave it and how to do the V engrave. But it was two giant pieces of wood put together. Our scenic department made it seem like one seamless giant piece and painted it to look like marble. That was engraved. They did a fantastic job. And I mean, the table is real big in mm-hmm. person, like a 10-foot diameter table. You've never probably seen that in your life, really.
Yeah, that is huge.
It's bigger than any table I've ever seen at any restaurant. And I love it. It's a great counterpoint to the one we see in the famous JSA photo that's popped up throughout the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just a little table that they're all crowded around.
Yeah.
You almost get the impression that like that was early days of the JSA.
Mm-hmm.
And they took that photo and were like, guys, we need a bigger table.
Yeah. Yeah. They just graduated a little bit.
But then these banners that are around the room, those were specifically shot and lighted to be evocative of the Alex Ross JSA paintings.
I was going to ask about that.
From the covers of Jeff's JSA run. Or his Justice Society of America run. His first JSA book was called JSA. His second one was called Justice Society of America. So some of them were shot specifically to match that. Some of them were already existing photos that we had from an earlier shoot that I had to sort of cheat and relight to make match those.
Mm-hmm.
But they were great. Some of the ones that didn't have real supersuits had to be touched up a little, like Green Lantern and Dr. Fate, for example. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to point out that the Flash was the one that looked the most like the Alex Ross inspiration.
Yeah, it absolutely did.
We didn't do anything to that. That guy, like, that's that guy's physique. No Photoshop. He's wearing that shirt with the lightning bolt. He's wearing the helmet. And that's the way that the light naturally fell on him. The way the photographer lit him, like, we didn't do anything to that guy, and it looks that amazing. I just wanted to call that out. And I don't know who that guy is, but he did a super great job, and the photographer was fantastic as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible.
And we'll come back to here for some more behind the scenes stuff that I have coming up later. Oh, one thing about the owl. There was a rumor going around set that owl had been in some of the Harry Potter movies.
Oh.
But more recently, when trying to figure out what owl it may have been, I looked up the life expectancy of owls, and I now highly doubt that he was in the Harry Potter movies.
Oh, that's a shame.
Also, those were shot in England. I don't know how much movie owls travel, but across the Atlantic for, you know, a 5-minute scene in a TV show seems unlikely.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend that it was a Harry Potter owl, though.
So, you know, Icicle, he's not a very scary villain in the comics.
No.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, none of these ice guys are. It's a pretty cheesy, kitschy thing. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger's Mr. Freeze.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they all have freeze rays and they make stuff cold and it's not that scary. I mean, we see how powerful his ice is when he ices up Stripe so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it landed on me how dangerous he was until this next scene.
When William goes to confront him about, well, even he wasn't even that confrontational, but he was like, please tell me it was an accident.
How did I not segue into this scene with talking about Harry Potter? Speaking of Harry Potter, William's heir comes in with a magic wand. Damn it.
We can try it again.
No, go ahead. Let everyone know how lame I am at my segues.
So Zarek is in there, and I just love, like, earlier in the episode, he was telling him, you know, you aren't, you know, being a true leader, and here he is, like, he's wanting him to have done this by accident so he doesn't actually have to act and react to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. He's, like, asking for a reason not to have to take action.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even consider that.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's all powered up. He's ready to blast him to atoms, presumably. We haven't really seen how powerful he is. We've only seen him actually use his powers once in the opening battle against the JSA when he was fighting Hourman.
Yeah, because Icicle just touches him and he just touches a wand and immediately freezes Zarek over, and he tells him that you need to understand I did this for Joey.
Yeah, it's almost like the instant he touches the wand, the ice is already like halfway to Zarek's central nervous system.
Yeah, there's no like suspense and drama of the slow crawl. It's just like, nope, I'm gonna touch you and you're dead.
There's no time for like fighting over the wand or anything. He just makes contact and his ice travels there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, they could have just had him shoot ice at him or like a number of other things, but there was something subtle and shocking and fast about the way they did it that I was just like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And we learn that later that killed him. On the news, we overhear it, and they said that he died from a heart attack.
I feel like we learned right away. That dude was frozen solid.
Yes, he was.
And then Icicle's parents are just like, yeah, we'll clean this up.
Mm-hmm.
So his other life is not a secret to his parents.
No. I'm curious how much his son knows.
It seems like probably not much, because his son wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like they would have had him there if he was in on it. Like the writers would have.
Yeah. He, in the beginning, right after his mom died, and Icicle goes out to the garden and he, you know, kind of yells and explodes and ices over everything. We do see that his son saw that happen.
Did we? I missed that.
Yeah, he was like back at the house, but he was looking out and saw that. At least that was my impression of it.
I'm going to have to rewatch that scene because I completely missed that.
But he may, you know, his mom just died. He may have repressed that. He may have, you know, thought, oh, that wasn't what I saw. I must be seeing things. So who knows what he actually knows.
For real.
But we find out that Cameron, the little flirty friend of Courtney, is Jordan Mockin's son. And I love that in the first scene when he was a kid, he drew a flower for his mom and she said, never stop drawing. And then he's painted the flowers and is doodling the flowers in this book. And I really like that he is also keeping up his promise to his mom.
Everything ties together really well. Like it's just such tight writing through and through.
And yeah, it is.
Again, Colleen McGinnis wrote this episode, and I think we should call that out because the first two episodes were written by Jeff, and you know Jeff oversees the writing for the whole season, and typically a showrunner will do a polish over the finished script, whoever writes it.
Mm-hmm.
So like the writer's room comes together and they all sort of work out what the episodes are going to be, and then each episode is assigned to a writer who then writes the script, and then the showrunner gives it a polish so that all the scripts have the same voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's so great that the first episode after the show creator, the first writer after the show creator is a woman.
Yeah, I think that is important.
I think it's really important to have female voices on the show, in the writer's room, behind the camera, because we want Courtney and the other women on the show to be believable, especially since Courtney has to carry the show.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
And another one of these little moments that ties in so well to something that went earlier is Barbara's the only person that showed up for family dinner. Mm-hmm. Mike had already had his dinner of Cheetos. And so now when she has an opportunity to join in on another meeting, she takes it. And she's the only one who doesn't turn up for family dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, do you think that this was something that landed on Pat as much as it should have? Because to me, it seemed like maybe it didn't, but it's hard to say.
I feel like it hasn't registered yet, but he also just had a lot going on with Courtney and Icicle and Joey and all that. So his mind is somewhere else, and I understand that. But I think this is definitely setting up for conflict later on in the show.
Mike calls it out, but not like, hey, is something wrong with Barbara? He's calling it out like, this isn't fair. Why do I have to be here if Barbara's not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And Pat's just like, not right now. Like, God, Mike, come on. Stop being a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
That's all I got out of it. So I think we're on the same page.
Mm-hmm. I definitely see in the future, though, like, if she starts working closely with Jordan and she's going to be supporting his ideas, if Courtney and Pat find out who Jordan really is, that's going to be a huge conflict there because they're not going to want to let on anything to Barbara to put her in danger with Icicle and all that. So I'm very curious how that's all going to play out.
I guess the only other thing to talk about, unless you have something you'd like to bring up, is back at the JSA headquarters.
Yep, I think that's where I'm heading to too.
So Courtney's like, well, if I'm going to start a superhero team, I'm going to need all this stuff that Pat was nice enough to explain to me.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just taking his words and his actions and twisting them.
Yeah. Well, I'm also curious, how did she get back in? Is it just like a key code entrance and she watched Pat put the numbers in?
Well, we do hear him enter a code in the first scene where they go in. You hear a beep, 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 and then they walk in.
So I guess she just memorized that code?
Or the staff might have known the code.
Yeah, that's true.
Or maybe there was a high up open window that Starman always used to get in and the staff flew her through that.
Yeah.
Who knows? So one thing I want to bring up is some of these items that she takes. We see her take, well, obviously the guys that we know are going to show up on the show later. Hourman, Dr. Midnight, and Wildcat. She grabs all their accoutrements. And then there are some that don't have uniforms there, just stuff. like mm-hmm. Green Lantern's power battery.
Yeah.
Which brings up another question. Was his ring there? I didn't see the ring. The power battery is not much good without the ring. But here's a little behind the scenes. If you want your own Stargirl official Green Lantern power battery, it is the one sold by DC Direct, Alan Scott's power battery. It's commercially available for a number of years now. I mean, I don't think they're still making new ones, but you can find them on eBay and such like. It was just that one that you can get commercially, stripped down. All the paint was taken off. It was completely repainted by our paint department to look old and aged. And then they went and busted up the lens because the lens has a little Green Lantern logo in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So they broke that and put a crack in the lens to make it look aged and take out all that corporate branding. But other than that, that's all you need. Just an awesome paint job that looks a lot better than the one as it's sold, honestly. And then there's that. And then the Thunderbolt, the pink pen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a pink pen, right? But you should know there were at least a dozen different pink pens that were looked at.
Really?
Doug, the prop master, bought up every kind of pink pen he could think of. He started with fountain pens. There were metal pens, pens of all stripes, before they finally settled on the one that they settled on. And it's just a plastic pen that has like a sort of metallic pink look to it. She takes that and we hear that little giggle and there's like a pink spark.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have noticed the pink lightning over Johnny Thunder's shoulder on his mural.
Yeah, this poster. Mm-hmm.
And that was the Thunderbolt. That's what's in that pen, if you're familiar with the comics. It's the same creature you can see on the JSA photo on the far right.
From what I've read of him in the comics, I really like that character. I don't know if he'll show up, but we'll see.
And we end with Courtney setting off to make herself to start recruiting.
Yeah, let's go do some recruiting.
She grabs the staff and heads out to Cobra style.
Yeah, so we will see who she starts with. I'm assuming she's going to start this right away because that's the way the Courtney is. So we'll see who she tries to recruit next week.
And we've talked quite a bit this episode about Icicle, obviously, because this episode is called Icicle. And I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking to Mr. Neil Jackson. And so we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and play for you my interview with Neil Jackson.
Stargirl After Show. Stargirl After Show.
Neil, thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Sean. How are you, mate?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much. So I guess we'll just jump right in. I wanted to ask you, in terms of comic book lore, were you a fan before getting into this at all?
I'm a fan of comic books, and it's an interesting thing with British people, as you can tell by my accent. Comic books weren't a massive thing when I was growing up. Comic books tended to be more of an American thing. There weren't comic book stores when I was a kid. In Britain, comic books tended to be the sort of Sunday supplements that came with the big newspapers. But they weren't the Batman, Superman, DC, Marvel type stuff. I was aware of them, and my sort of biggest introduction to comic books was the X-Men cartoon. When the X-Men cartoon came out, I was a huge, huge fan of that. And you were able to get sort of comic book almanacs of multiple issues and a hardback cover. So I remember reading a few Thor when I was a kid. But I loved comic books, but just wasn't a voracious reader of them because it wasn't part of our culture. I knew of Stargirl because I've been friends with Jeff Johns for 15 years. We worked together on a TV series adaptation of Blade that was called Blade the Series that we shot 15 years ago in Vancouver. Met Jeff for the first time on that one. He was one of the writers on it, and we became friends. So I knew of Stargirl, and I knew that Stargirl was obviously a hugely personal pet project for him for all the reasons that everybody who's a fan of the show will know. But I'd never read any of the comics. And honestly, when I looked at a couple of the comics, they always seemed like they skewed a little younger than my taste would go. It was always very sort of smash pop, bright colors kind of stuff. And so I didn't know a great deal about it. And it was January last year, so 2019, I got a call from Jeff, and he said, "I'm not sure if you're aware, but we're putting together a live action TV version of Stargirl, and I'd love you to be a part of it to play Jordan McKent." And hugely flattered, because obviously to be offered a role anyway as an actor is hugely flattering, but to be offered a role by Jeff, who's a friend of mine, to be a part of his prep project, I knew that it was a huge honor to be something a part of. And he started telling me about the character. He said, let me just give you a little bit of a breakdown. He said he's called Jordan McKent. He's a businessman, but he's also this incredibly powerful supervillain, part of the Injustice Society, which flagged me for a second. I'm like, they're called the Injustice Society, which is so fun in the show when Courtney calls reference to some of these names. I was like, oh good, they're mentioning it, kind of like in the Shazam way of doing stuff, that they're politely mocking the way that it's a little tongue-in-cheek. And then he said, yeah, Jordan has the ability to turn himself into ice, and he's this character called Icicle. And again, I kind of chuckled to myself. I was like, Icicle doesn't sound like the most threatening of names. He sounds more like a sort of My Little Pony character than he does this vicious villain that's going to inflict dread in the hearts of his enemies.
Now, did you happen to Google any pictures of Icicle and maybe get a little worried?
I did. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Jeff pitched it all to me over the phone, and he said, let me give you a full breakdown of what we want to do with it. And once he started getting into the character, of course I knew it was going to be brilliant written, because it's Jeff, and Jeff is a genius. But when he started telling me about the backstory of Icicle, about the fact that he had fallen in love with this wonderful woman and then had a child, and then she had ended up getting cancer, and she ends up dying from cancer, and it's not her fault, and it was all brought on by this nefarious company who were doing this ill-gotten stuff. And as a result of that one Nexus moment, then Jordan made it his mission in life to make sure nobody would ever have to suffer this injustice again. I suddenly went, this guy's not a villain. This guy's a hero. There's everything about his motivations is understandable and justifiable. And I think very few people, just from the description that I just said, will find fault in what he's trying to do. He's ultimately trying to make the world a better place and make sure that people never have to have what happened to his wife. It just so happens the methods that he goes about it aren't exactly the way that most people would condone. But the moment I understood his motivations for everything, I fell in love with this character and just went, he's not a villain. I know how to play him. He's a man who is being incredibly stricken by grief and anger, and is trying to get redemption for what happened to his wife. But moreover, he's trying to make sure that the world he leaves his son, their son, is better than the one they're currently in. And that excited me. But then I Googled Icicle on the internet and started seeing these sort of Jack Frost, Rumpelstiltskin imps.
Yeah, he looks like a Rankin Bass character.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, that doesn't seem to fit in with the description that Jeff just gave me. And then I was back in Britain at the time, and I was shooting the Kingsman movie. And we were chatting back and forth about costume design and the initial look. They sent me this great artist rendering of Icicle, that the way the head would look, and they'd done it using my head as a model. And it's very, very similar to the way he ends up in the final version that I've just seen in the extended trailer. But the costume, they said they sent through some costume designs, and they wanted to do an homage to the stuff in the comic books, where he's ranges from being dressed as this sort of silver-clad imp to these white outfits, all really leaning into the frost and the ice metaphor. And what they sent through was a form-fitting sort of lycra snakeskin silver tracksuit was going to be the initial Icicle look. And I was like, I couldn't wrap my head around it. I couldn't wrap my head around the idea from the breakdown, the description that he'd given me, the idea that there's this high power businessman in these wonderful bespoke suits and he dresses really expensively. And then he goes down to his lair to start doing his real plan as part of the Injustice Society. And the costume that he chooses to put on looks like he should be at a sort of German discotheque in the 80s. It didn't seem to make sense to me. So I started talking to him. I said, the way I see it and the way that you were talking about it was, he sounds like a guy who's on a mission. So what if we lent into the military aspect of it and made him more combative? He's putting on an outfit because he's ready to get his hands dirty. He's taking off his $1,000 suit and he's putting on a practical outfit that allows him to physically fight for the things that he wants, that he can't do as Jordan. And so we bounced back ideas. I managed to find an original panel from one of the comics that had Icicle in combat gear. He had a bulletproof vest on and looked very much like a SWAT soldier. And we liked that, and they took shades of that and ended up working with the costume designer and Jeff, and they came up with the look for Icicle, which thankfully is more in line with the description that Jeff initially gave me of a guy who's grief-stricken and is trying to enact this mission to save the world.
Yeah, a cartoonish outfit doesn't really convey that, does it?
Not really. I mean, it was this thing of just... And they've done it brilliantly with the series, both in dialogue and the way that they kind of play with it, is acknowledging that some of the elements of the Stargirl universe and the Justice Injustice Society are a little kitsch. I mean, for the fact that the main villain is called Icicle. Icicle isn't a name that enacts a great deal of dread, in the same way that Justice Society and Injustice Society is very kitsch. But they acknowledge that in a very... respectful and intelligent way. And I wanted to make sure that with my character, at least, we leaned away from the kitsch, because the kitsch is already inherent in it. It's a superhero character, so it can easily lean into the kitsch. So trying to ground that as much as possible through the character's emotions made the most sense. And thankfully, we ended up with an outfit for Icicle that is amazing. And incredibly hot, actually. We didn't think about that. We were shooting in Atlanta in the summer, and I end up wearing a cashmere sweater with a thick overcoat. So a man made of ice was actually in reality just sweating buckets underneath that.
Well, that's the curse of pretty much any superhero film, isn't it?
Yeah.
When they shoot in Atlanta, and a lot do.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the cheesiness of the name, the Injustice Society, and Jordan has a line when he's talking to William Zarek on the porch that he's fighting injustice, which you also mentioned. And I think that that's a really brilliant way, because when you see something like Injustice Society or the Crime Syndicate or any of these other names, it's really hard to give an organization with that name an altruistic purpose.
Yes.
But Jeff found a way.
That's the brilliance of Jeff. It's taking what was existing within these characters, within this world, and modernizing it in a way that makes it palpable to modern audiences. And that's exactly what you said there about Jordan saying he's fighting injustice. That was the hook that made me excited to be a part of this show and excited to play Jordan / Icicle, is the fact that he's not a villain. This terrible, heinous injustice happened to him and to his wife and their family. And he just so happens to have the power and the mental acuity to fight this injustice and make sure that nobody else has to suffer from it going forward. And that as a character trait is fascinating, because the thing that I love most about that is, yeah, COD villains are great and they have a place. The sort of Mike Myers of the world have a great place as canons in movies and lore. But the ones that are more nuanced and layered are the ones that are far more interesting for me to watch and also far more interesting for me to play. And what I love about the third episode, the Icicle episode, is we get this glimpse into the backstory and motivations behind Jordan and what led him to become the man that we see all those years later. And I'm really hoping that it's going to create conflict within the audience, because of course everyone's going to want to choose a side, and surely they're going to choose the side of the Justice Society with Stargirl, and that's going to be pitted against the Injustice Society and Icicle. So they're going to be looking to Icicle as being this villain. But what episode 3 does so brilliantly is it turns that on its head by giving plausible motivations behind Jordan's actions and making sure that we understand that he's not just doing this for this mustache twirling nefarious reasons, but he's actually motivated by something that's pure and completely understandable, and that most people on the planet would have the same feelings if something happened to one of their loved ones. They would want to get revenge. They would want to make sure this doesn't happen. It's going to cause this conflict in the audiences that once a skerrick of sympathy, once a skerrick of empathy comes in for Icicle, which will happen in episode 3, it can't not happen. Suddenly we have a really interesting, dramatic dynamic that we get to play off for the rest of the season, that audiences are going to watch Courtney and want to support her, but some part of them is going to want to support Icicle because they understand and they believe in what he's doing. And if we can achieve that, we've got something that's really fascinating for audiences to tune in every single week.
Yeah, and I think it's important for any villain, really, to have that. There's not been a compelling villain probably in the history of storytelling that thought of themselves as the bad guy.
Yeah, no. I mean, look, you go back through movie history and through literature history, the best villains are the ones who believe that they're justified. I mean, look, even Hitler thought that he was right in his own way. And I don't think there's anybody who's sitting there twiddling their mustache going, I'm going to do evil today. I don't think there's a person on the planet. They may be mentally misguided or impaired, but in their own mind, they're justified that their actions are the absolute right actions. And tapping into that in a way that makes other people start to see their perspective and maybe not root for them, but understand them is a really powerful thing that we've managed to do, and what Jeff has managed to do with Stargirl.
So we're talking about all the motivations of Jordan, who is a well-intentioned bad guy, let's say. In general, in your career, and I want to go back and talk a bit about your broader career, but do you prefer playing bad roles or protagonistic roles?
I like playing good roles. I like playing characters who have a lot of internal conflict in them. And they can be heroes, they can be anti-heroes, they can be antagonist, protagonist, as long as they seem three-dimensional to me, because that's, we all have that. I mean, it's like you can be the most saintly person in the world, but at the right day or the wrong day, and the right or wrong moment, somebody cuts you up in traffic, you can find yourself uttering some things that you wouldn't want the rest of the world to hear. We all have these shades to us. Nobody is 100% good, and that's why, in my opinion, the most boring character in fictional history is Superman, because he's so good and he's so powerful that the reason he's fascinating to me is because of the Lex Luthors of the world and the people that come up against him, because they have these layers. They have this sort of interesting dynamics that makes us human. So I gravitate towards three-dimensional characters. It just so happens most of them happen to be on the, in quotations, villainous scale. And also, villains are unencumbered. Heroes, whether they're anti-heroes or not, they tend to have to live by some level of a code, so that the audiences ultimately root for them. Whereas the villain doesn't. He can really say and do whatever he wants or whatever is necessary to get his goal attained. And that's way more interesting to me.
That's an excellent point. So now to talk about your wider career, I was a little astonished, honestly. It looks like your first role was in about 2002 in film and television. And you've had 60 credits since then.
Wow.
That is not a long time to amass 60 credits, Neil Jackson.
I don't know, is that many? Yeah, honestly, I pinch myself with my career. I was born in Luton, which is 20 miles north of London. It's a town that is wonderful and also a little rough. It's a working class town. I kind of liken it, to Americans, to a sort of Detroit. It's very much that kind of a town built on the car industry with very blue collar workers. I loved it there. Not a single soul that I knew or knew about was in the film or television industry. I didn't even know that there was an entertainment industry. I just thought that TV and film was made somewhere else in some magical kingdom. And so it never even entered my sphere. And I'm still that 10-year-old boy from Luton who would beg his dad to go and take him to the cinema so he can go and see Superman or Herbie Goes Bananas or whatever was on at the cinema at the time. I loved being in that world, and I loved the magic of watching these stories being told on this big picture. And so the idea that I get to be on these sets like Stargirl, like Kingsman, like the Bond franchise just boggles me. And there's honestly not a day that goes by when I'm on set that I don't have a little internal giggle and just like, meh. You know, it's almost like I've heard actors saying they're waiting to be found out. They keep waiting for somebody to be like, oh, what are you doing here? No, you're not supposed to be. There was a mistake. I don't feel that. I don't feel like somebody's going to kick me out. I just feel like somebody's given me the keys and I can't believe that they let me do this, because I never in my childhood even understood that such a thing was possible. And then to stand on a set like Stargirl with the huge robot that had been built, the practical stripe that had been built, and these amazing costumes and wonderful collaborators like Jeff Johns and all the directors that we had on, and yourself doing the incredible work that you did, Sean, it's just, is a dream come true for me. And I pinch myself every single day.
You've had quite the career, and not just as an actor. You're also a screenwriter. You've directed some. And like you mentioned, you took, what, two titles, boxing in Wales?
Yeah, I boxing as an amateur, we... there's a thing called the British University... what was it? British University Championships. And so all the universities in Britain get together and compete in various different sports, like a mini sort of Commonwealth Games or Olympics. And this goes on throughout the year. And I entered into the British University Championships the first year I started boxing. I've been doing martial arts, but I'd only been boxing for about 3 months and went in. And by some weird miracle, I ended up winning the championships at light middleweight. And then went back 2 years later and won at a middleweight. So, and then was boxing as an amateur and was second in Wales. And I ended up having a really nice career before transitioning and pretending to be people.
And you're also a musician?
Yeah, I
listened to some of your songs on your website and I'm into them. They're good.
Oh, nice. Thank you, mate. I tell you what it is. I think that no artist is just a single artist. There's not very few people operate in one medium and one medium only. I find that a lot of writers like to paint. I find that a lot of musicians like to write. I find that people tend to cross-pollinate between various different mediums, especially now more than ever, where it's more and more palpable. Actually, quite a few people that are in the cast of Stargirl are multi-hyphenates. You've got Jake. He's an amazing musician, brilliant guitarist, got an incredible voice. He's got songs that have been released. Same with Meg DeLacy. She's an incredible singer and songwriter. Chris Baker, who I actually lived with while we were shooting Stargirl, who plays Brainwave, is an incredible blues guitarist. We used to sit of the evening just having a gin and tonic and he'd be playing these amazing blues riffs. I think that quite a few people dabble in various different platforms, and it's always been this thing for me that I want to sate my creativity in whatever way that is. And the music was a big thing for me for a while, but once I recorded the album, then recorded an EP, in order for me to pursue music, at least at that point, with more ardor, would have meant me sacrificing my acting career, because I would have had to go on tour, I would have had to turn down jobs. And it was just at the point that my acting career was really starting to move. So I made the decision to focus on my acting career, which I don't regret at all, but the guitar always travels with me.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, I guess I can relate. You know, I've got my graphics work, I've got all my podcasts. I'm a less accomplished multi-hyphenate.
It's not really about accomplishment. It's really about just pursuing a thing that makes you passionate. And if one thing and one thing solely is the thing that makes you passionate, then great, pursue that one thing. But we live in a world where diversity is more than ever possible and applauded. And if you like this podcast for you, I mean, you're an amazing graphic artist and very much respected throughout the industry. And then you've got these other passions that keep you going. And if you can juggle them all at once, then more power to you.
So getting back to your acting career, I have a question for you. Maybe you won't like it. I don't know. But why is it, Neil, that you are the only British person who has not appeared in a Harry Potter movie or on Doctor Who?
Because there's a conspiracy against me. I don't know, mate. I mean, I honestly don't know. I mean, Harry Potter was, as I was starting my career, Harry Potter was kind of into episode 5, I guess. And I'd already moved to the States. So Harry Potter, maybe if I'd have stayed in Britain, then maybe I may have got auditions and Harry Potter might have been something. And the same with Doctor Who, the resurgence of Doctor Who happened once I was already living in the States. And I actually got offered an episode of Doctor Who maybe 4 years ago, but it clashed with a project that I was already shooting. It would have been great fun to go into Doctor Who and do something like that. I think it's just one of those things of, I have been living in North America now for 15 years, and a lot of those shows are local casting and happening locally. And also, as you said, and hearing you say it is astounding to me, with 60 credits over the course of 18 years, I've been very busy, and there's a lot of stuff I've missed out on because of other work that I've been doing.
That was actually what made me ask you that, because you don't see many Brits with such a prolific resume that haven't been on one of those two properties. But if you've been living in the States for that large, in North America for that long, then that definitely makes sense.
Yeah. And I would never change anything. It's like I've had these conversations with my acting teacher, who I love to death back in Britain, Michael Armstrong, who's my mentor. And 3.5 years into my acting career, I made the decision to move to the States. And I was just getting established in the UK, and I'd done a couple of films, one big one being Alexander, the Oliver Stone film. And when I knew that the premiere was going to be happening in LA, I came over to LA for the premiere and ended up staying for 5 days just to see what LA was like. And in those 5 days, I got more auditions than I probably had in 6 months in the UK. There's just way more content at that time. And so I thought, I'll give it a go and come over and chance my arm. And I didn't work for the first 8 months of being here, but got sniffs at things, and it made me realize that there's a lot more potential for me over in the States. And the first job I actually booked in the States was Stargate, SG-1, and I got to play an amazing character called Kalik on that, which was a one-off standalone episode, but that became a real fan favorite. And I've talked about it. I was like, who knows what my career would have been if I stayed in Britain, but you just can't think like that. At the time when I was in Britain, the sort of contemporaries I was auditioning against, Michael Fassbender and various people like this, and they've had the careers that they've had, and I wouldn't change a second of my career. I feel very honored to have done and been involved in the projects that I've been with, working with the people I've got to work with. I mean, like Robert Zemeckis, 2.5 years ago, I got to do a Robert Zemeckis movie, and 10-year-old me, when I was 10, that was when Who Framed Roger Rabbit came out. And I saw that in the movie, in the cinema 3 times. And I remember begging my parents to take me to the cinema, and bless them, they came along and they sat with me 2 extra times past having seen it already. And I bought the book of it, the production book, and I had a Who Framed Roger Rabbit cuddly doll that I would carry around with me in a very rough neighborhood in Luton, almost challenging anybody to say anything because I was so enamored by this world that he created. It just, it transported me and blew my 10-year-old mind open. So to get to stand on set with Robert Zemeckis and him calling action on scenes that I'd done, and now in my office to have an original poster from Who Framed Roger Rabbit with Robert Zemeckis having written Welcome to Toontown on it. It astounds me.
That's amazing. And something I can very much relate to because that is one of my all-time favorite films. My best friend and I used to literally just walk around reciting the entire movie from memory.
It's so good. That was my terrible Who Framed Roger Rabbit impersonation.
It's better than mine, which is also terrible. I've had a lot of practice at doing that terribly because on my other podcast, Table Reads, we read scripts for movies that never got made.
Okay.
And one of them we did was Roger Rabbit Toon Platoon, written by Nat Mulder. And the whole premise of my podcast is they're mostly really bad and we do a lot of mockery.
Right.
That was the first scripts that we read on the podcast that was astonishingly good. And it was written right after Roger Rabbit came out. And I don't know why it didn't get made into a movie.
Doesn't it just break your heart when you see stuff like that? I mean, that's one of the big takeaways that I've got from 20 years now of doing this is that nobody knows. I mean, it's that William Goldman thing, right? Nobody knows anything. And anybody who says they know anything is either a liar or delusional. Because I've read some incredible projects. I'm just like, God, this is a slam dunk. And then it's ended up either not being made or it's been made and not been particularly good. And I've read some stuff that's just like, oh, this doesn't come off the page. And when it's finally been made, I'm like, this is incredible. And the amount of work that goes into every iteration of this industry. I mean, you know yourself from the graphic design world, the amount of time that you would spend working on something that might not even make the shot, might not even make the edit, but the amount of hours that you've spent sweating on that. And that's the most humbling thing that I find with this industry is that every single person involved in it works so hard to make sure that what is on screen is the best it can possibly be. And that even means sometimes the work that they're doing never makes it.
You know, there's a really good example of that in the Icicle episode.
Yeah.
You know, Pat takes Courtney to the JSA headquarters.
Okay.
And knowing that was coming up, I did a logo for the JSA, like a seal with the eagle and everything and the shield. And spent probably a couple weeks of iterations on it, like dozens of iterations. And it made it to set, but it is not in the episode.
But this is the stuff that, I mean, it comes back to passion, right? I mean, I've talked multiple times about passion to me is everything. And I would much rather talk to a passionate bricklayer than an apathetic astronaut. You know, if somebody is passionate about something, that's infectious and it's fascinating. And to do what we do, to do what you do, you need passion. You need passion to spend, as you said, a couple of weeks designing, redesigning, working on something in the hope that it makes the cut. And if it doesn't, that's okay. That's part of the process. And then you throw that passion into the next thing. And that's the stuff that obviously builds careers. But moreover, that's the stuff that makes the collaborative process of film and television making so exciting to me, because when it works, and it worked on Stargirl, everybody is carrying that passion into everything. I mean, the DPs, the gaffers, the lighting people, everybody. I mean, even the catering. The catering was phenomenal. Everybody is invested in this project, trying to do everything they can to make it the best it can be. And when it works and it clicks like that, like on a show like Stargirl, it transcends. And I'm so excited to see that on screen.
It's has been really amazing to watch thus far. The show's coming together so well. It's cinematic, really. Visually speaking, you know, it's being put on the CW after it's on the DC Universe app. And as much as I love the CW shows, none of them hold a candle in terms of style or visuals to Stargirl. It's just beyond the pale.
That's great to hear. That's really great to hear. And everything starts from the top, right? It trickles down. And we happen to have the best in the business in Geoff Johns standing in the number one position. He is leading the charge. And his passion, his enthusiasm, and also he's an incredibly gracious collaborator. It's one of the things that I've always loved about him is that he's very quick to say no, and he's also very quick to say yes. He has a very clear, singular vision about what he wants, but if something improves upon that, he's very quick to jump on that and bring that in. He wants everybody's input. And that was proven to me from the get-go with this, which I knew it would because I've known Geoff for a long while, but to collaborate with him on the costume so closely and come to something that we all agreed was the perfect iteration of what this character was. And then also the look of Jordan. It turned out we were semi-hamstrung in a very good way because I was shooting this World War One, the Kingsman movie. And so they were in first position. So they'd hired me first, which means they'd locked the look for my character for that. Which
so
means
you had to have that short cropped hair.
Yeah, we couldn't cut my hair. But that hairstyle actually worked. And what we decided to do was, I'm blonde anyway, but what they wanted to do was to give the nod to Icicle and also to the Nordic roots from where Jordan came from, is really play up the blondness. And so we ended up putting a dye in my hair and really pulling out the blonde highlights, which worked perfectly because the only stuff I had left to shoot, and we had to liaise very closely with the Kingsman, was me wearing a World War One helmet. All the stuff with me without the helmet had already been shot, which meant that we couldn't change the hairstyle in case they needed to do a reshoot, but we could doctor the hair because it was going to be hidden by this hat. And turning him so incredibly blonde just worked for the character because not only does it give the doffed cap to the icicle nature, but it makes him seem slightly more statuesque. You know, it's a very dark show, as you've seen and as your audience will know by now, having watched a few of it, in terms of tone, the color saturation. We shot it, the way they lit it was very dark and ominous and shadowy. And so to have Jordan being this very, very blonde, and I'm very pale, I'm borderline albino, character in there kind of just made him pop a little more within the color palette, which was a brilliant idea. And that was Geoff's suggestion and the hair and makeup crew.
And again, the hair and makeup, the costumes, everybody was really on point for this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, a real treat for me, there were multiple treats for me when we were shooting Stargirl, but one of the real treats for me was Nelson Lee has been a dear friend of mine ever since we worked together on Blade, which is where we both met Geoff. And he plays Dragon King in this. And I'd already shot the first couple of episodes. And when Dragon King is introduced, I'm not sure where it is in episode 3 or 4. The very first scene that Nelson had on Stargirl was in the Injustice Society lair with just me. And we came in, we did a quick audition, a quick rehearsal, and then they cleared the set and Geoff walked in and I teared up. We had this little moment of, I haven't been on set with Nelson, even though we're very, very close friends for 15 years. Haven't been on set with Geoff, even though we know each other very well for 15 years. And here the three of us having this reunion, playing these amazing characters on this show that Geoff was had created, was a really emotional moment. We all had a little hug and an acknowledgement to this, and that was a real gift for me.
It's really great. I don't really have anything on that level that I experienced, but I was there when Jeff saw Stripe fully assembled for the first time.
Wow.
And just seeing, like, he was just staring at it with like this smile on his face. And
I
was like,
imagine, I mean, I can't imagine what that's like. And one day I hope to get to imagine what, see what that's like, but to have an idea in your head that then you put down on paper, then you get inked into a comic book 25 years ago with the first iteration. And then 25 years later to see a character you created fully actualized in a physical form has got to just be breathtaking.
Yeah, I asked him, I said, did you ever think back in, you know, 1999 that you would be standing and looking at this? And he's like, no, no.
Yeah.
And that's the magic of the show in general, I think, is Jeff's passion for it kind of goes, it trickles down. That's the real trickle down economy, is Jeff's passion at the top of the Stargirl pyramid or whatever, trickling down to everybody and infecting us all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Now I have I wanted to come up with one question that I would ask everybody. Just because I thought it was kind of fun.
Okay.
And that is, if you couldn't have played Icicle on this show, what other role would you have been interested in? Like, what other role do you wish you could have played if not Icicle?
That's a really good question. The other role I think I would want to play is actually Pat. I think that role is fascinating to me. I mean, for all the conflict reasons that we've talked about before, and Luke Wilson plays it just so perfectly. He is a man who is very righteous and honorable, who has seen his friend die in his arms. He's resigned to the fact he's always going to be the sidekick, but he's the person that's got everybody's back, and he's always looking at the big picture to try to make sure that everybody is safe. He's an incredibly noble and honorable character. But within there, he's kind of harboring this secret as well. He's been harboring this secret for a long while from his wife, played by Amy Smart, and from his step daughter, and from his son. And he has this incredible arc in it, even though he is, in quotations, a sidekick. He's every part the hero that I think Stargirl is, because he's the guy that brings everybody together. He's the glue that binds the Justice Society. And he's also a lot of fun.
The other thing that I find really interesting about Pat as a character is, despite clearly exhibiting all these heroic traits, he also is very, very unsure of himself.
Yeah.
He has almost no self-confidence.
I mean, it's completely human. I mean, how many people have we all met who are, in their own right, from the outset, brilliant? But when you tell them that you think they're brilliant, it's a shock to them. I mean, that humility is what makes us human, but it's also an incredibly attractive trait. Because it's very difficult to accept. You just go about doing it. I mean, he's a man driven by his circumstances. He is inherently heroic, but because of the circumstances presented to himself, he finds a way to step up and be of service to make sure that he can help the situation improve. And I think that's so fascinating. He is a reluctant hero.
Yeah, when he sets off to confront Icicle, he thinks that he's going to make the ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah.
He says, if I'm not back by morning, you get your family out of here.
Mm-hmm.
That might actually be when he heads off against Brainwave. Now I'm getting confused.
Regardless, he as you said, he's ready to make the ultimate sacrifice to protect the people that he loves. He's a great character. He would have been a really fun one to play. I'm very glad I didn't have to play it, because Luke plays it better than I ever possibly could. He's so good on screen.
Neil, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
My pleasure, Sean.
You've been a fantastic interview.
Lovely chatting to you as always, dude.
Stargirl After Show.
So, Sarah, what did you think?
He is such like a passionate person. I really enjoyed listening to him talk about everything, and I love how into the character he was and finding the motivation behind it. I thought that was really great.
Yeah, his passion for his craft is really, really apparent when he talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like the kind of thing you can fake. Like, he has a real love for finding these characters and mm-hmm. inhabiting them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, that isn't our whole conversation. Neil and I talked about stuff that's coming down the road that we can't play yet because it's all very spoilery. So we will be playing the extended interview with him at the end of the season. Once the season's over, we're going to have extended versions of all these interviews. And those top out at an hour or more, typically. There's a lot more stuff in them. Get to hear all about fighting James Bond and all sorts of fun stuff.
I'm excited to listen to all of it. I also really like that he would play Pat if he was an icicle, mostly because I have a little bit of a crush on Pat because I think he's such a great guy.
So also check out his Instagram, The Neil Jackson. He does a lot of working out and fitness challenges and stuff. So very, very motivating, that guy. Like, if you feel like you need to get in shape or want to get in shape, I find his Instagram to shame me because I'm not doing these things. But, you know, once I'm not so busy, sure, I'm going to get motivated.
Go and get and ripped.
Get in Neil Jackson shape. Yeah, I'm going to get ripped. All right, guys, next week we'll be back for episode 4. And then we will be talking to Yvette Monreal, who plays Yolanda Montez. And she is just a sweetheart. And on our way out, I'm just going to leave you with a little clip of our discussion with her. So stay tuned for that in just a second. Sarah, do you have anything else you want to say before we go?
If you are interested in the Nancy Drew TV show, I encourage you to watch it on the CW and then tune into What's New Nancy Drew, and you can hear me and my co-host Ben talk all about the episodes and the mysteries and try and solve what's going on.
Yeah, and also go to tablereadspodcast.com if you want to hear three guys just read and riff on scripts that never got made. We're currently reading through The Star Wars, the 1974 first draft of Star Wars by George Lucas, which is vastly different and not very good.
Yeah, it's a great listen.
So we'll see you next week. Listen to Yvette here in a second. And until we see you, have a super great day.
This is Yvette Monreal, and you're listening to Stargirl After Show. And so I'm like, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I don't know why I felt the need to make my jump different or something, but I jumped and I span around and I plopped on the floor, but then like I fell backwards and then everyone started laughing and they were just like, that's great, because I actually continued my lines. I'm like, oh, I didn't fall on my feet, but I'm good. I just like kind of improvised the scene a little bit, and it was just the most hilarious thing, and it just felt really right and really, really good. Like, the casting really liked it. I liked it. Of course, I did another take where I didn't fall on my butt.
Stargirl After Show is a production of Fandom Limb Media.